The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's been a busy week here at Edstone with the ongoing youth camp that we've had here on this beautiful campus. It's been nice and chilly through the week, but it hasn't slowed down the camp at all. I want to just thank Brent Nachtigall and Richard Palmer for sitting in for me the last couple of days while we've been trying to keep up with some of the lectures and then even some of the physical activities as well. Last night we had a fun activity just down the road, I think 4 or 5 miles away, this nice wakeboarding facility and a barbecue. We took all of our food out there. We took the grill out there and cooked up the evening meal, and all of the campers and a few of the workers as well were able to get on this this wakeboarding. I guess there was a zip line across a man-made pond that allowed for you to get up on a wakeboarding, just like you were trailing a boat in a huge lake, except it was just on a small little pond, man-made pond. So a really good opportunity for the young people, many of them, to get to try something they had never tried before. And of course, that evening activity followed a rigorous day of sports activities here at Edstone. Brad McDonald and I were able to jump in with the two boys dorms, to play flag football with them at the start of yesterday. And the girls were out running around playing touch rugby. I think they got to play basketball as well. And I think both the guys and the gals were able to play a soccer match yesterday afternoon as well. The day before that, the day that Brent subbed in on radio, we were all down in London. We all got on a bus early in the morning, drove down into the city a couple of hours, and were dropped off at the British Museum, where we stayed for a couple of hours, and then we walked across part of London over to the Churchill War Rooms right near 10 Downing Street. So we were able to see both of these incredible museums. And even ahead of that, the night before, we had a lecture from Chris Eames about the British Museum in particular. And he basically gave all of us a kind of a roadmap of the museum and just the key artifacts that we wanted to try to search out and find, those that had to do with Bible history. So we had the lecturing, the education that went on the day before, and then just the opportunity to see so much in those two museums. Physically, it was a fairly demanding day. I think in total, we walked about 7 miles around London, and I think half of the walk was in pouring down rain. And so it was a memorable day for sure. Inside, of course, it was nice and dry and very educational. But a bit of a challenge getting from place to place. And yet, I told the counselors yesterday morning, I didn't hear any complaining at all. So the campers were just certainly maintaining a positive outlook and I think also just really enjoying the field trip. This morning, following the wakeboarding last night, we did tweak the schedule somewhat to add one more strenuous activity before all the dorms were set to head off for dance classes today. We added a touch rugby match for the boys, and then a full court basketball game for the girls. And of course, we're coming into the Sabbath this evening, and ahead of that, we're hoping to have a short CrossFit style games for the boys, and then later tonight, heading into the Sabbath, all of us gathering around a fire for what we hope will be a lively fireside chat between the adults and workers and all of the campers as well. One big happy family. It's a wonderful, wonderful program, as I've been stressing over the last week or so. These youth programs, that follow in the tradition of Herbert W. Armstrong and the many camps and youth programs that he established, in particular there toward the end of his life. There was a program that his church, the Worldwide Church of God, put together back in 1984. Most of it is a narration of the church's many youth programs. But there's a couple of clips in the middle of the program. It's an excellent program, by the way, titled The Heart of the Children. And about midway into this program, you have Mr. Armstrong explaining what went into these camps and what children in the Worldwide Church of God came away from those camps having learned and experienced. This is clip number 3.
Yes, they come here and have fun. But the thing is, they get a new definition of fun. Some children have come to these camps that have been trying to get fun out of drugs, smoking marijuana, and then even worse things. They learn that that's no fun and it's only harming and damaging them. But they learn things here and skills that really are fun and that are enjoyable. Now, we're trying to teach children at these camps some of the better things of life that are worth more than just money. Doing, giving, helping. They learn character here. They learn discipline. This is, in 3 weeks, the transformation that is made in the lives of these children is unbelievable.
3 weeks, and what a transformation. Our headquarters camp is 3 weeks long. The one here at Edstone is 2 weeks. 5 weeks altogether. We have a few campers here that have gone to both. 5 weeks of summer camp this summer. And to think about the things that they're learning. I mean, what really and truly is fun, the fun that will continue right on into the future and not cause some kind of a painful boomerang to come back on you. Character. These are character-building opportunities where young people can learn discipline and learn how to give and learn how to share and do and help. And look at how much that's needed, particularly in this evil world where Satan has really targeted the young people. I received this article this morning, both from Sam and Richard, who flagged it for me, this Atlantic piece by Jean Twenge. She's the author of Generation Me. She's been researching generational differences over the past 25 years or so. And the title of her piece is, Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation? Look at what smartphones, and she talks a fair bit too about social media in this article. Look at what it's done to our young people. I mean, this article talks about how that young people today, and when you look at some of the horrible statistics from a generation ago, you can read this article quickly and think, oh, well, maybe things are better. Teen pregnancies are down. Drug use is going down a little bit. Teen crime rates are going down. But if you really dig into this lengthy piece at the Atlantic, you see that while that may be happening, because young people more and more are just staying home in their rooms with their devices, with their phones, and their minds are closing because of it. They're living in another world because of it. And it comes at a time when, well, look at the world we live in. That's what we talk about so much on this program. They're going to be totally blinded to the reality of Matthew 24, 21, and 22. It says here in this Atlantic piece, around 2012, I mean, this is something, and I've stressed in recent weeks too, just how rapid the changes for the worse, have been in the last few years with all this transgender rights and so on, homosexual rights and so on. But she says here around 2012, that's just 5 months ago, or sorry, 5 years ago, around 2012, I noticed abrupt shifts in teen behaviors and emotional states. The biggest difference between the millennials and their predecessors was in how they viewed the world. Teens today differ from the millennials, not just in their views, but in how they spend their time. The experiences they have every day are radically different from those of the generation that came of age just a few years before them. And so what's so different about this teenage generation as compared to the one from just 10, 15 years ago? It says, what happened in 2012 to cause such dramatic shifts in behavior? It was after the Great Recession, which officially lasted from 2007 to 2009, and had a starker effect on millennials trying to find a place in a sputtering economy. But it was exactly the moment when the proportion of Americans who owned a smartphone surpassed 50%. And so she talks here about, well, she has one case in particular, this gal that she interviews throughout the piece, who says that she just would rather stay home with her phone than go out and do anything. This author has coined the phrase iGen, I-G-E-N, the internet generation. Born between 1995 and 2012, members of this generation are growing up with smartphones, have an Instagram account before they start high school, and do not remember a time before the internet. The millennials grew up with the web as well, but it wasn't ever present in their lives. At hand at all times, day and night. iGen's oldest members were early adolescents when the iPhone was introduced in 2007, and high school students when the iPad entered the scene in 2010. It says a 2017 survey of more than 5,000 American teens found that 3 out of 4 owned an iPhone. 3 out of 4 American teens have an iPhone. 3 out of 4. That's according to a survey from this year. I mean, that's a dramatic increase over what it was just a few years ago. And of course, the iPhone's only been around for 10 years. It says the advent of the smartphone and its cousin, the tablet, was followed quickly by hand-wringing about the deleterious effects of screen time. It says, but the impact of these devices has not been fully appreciated and goes far beyond the usual concerns about curtailed attention spans. The arrival of the smartphone has radically changed every aspect of teenagers' lives, from the nature of their social interactions to their mental health. These changes have affected young people in every corner of the nation and in every type of household. The trends appear among teens, poor and rich, of every ethnic background, in cities, suburbs, small towns. Where there are cell towers, there are teens living their lives on their smartphone. So they're all being influenced by this. They're all connected, 75%. Satan's influence. I mean, it can get anywhere that there's a cell tower. She says here, more comfortable in their bedrooms than in a car or at a party, today's teens are physically safer than teens have ever been. They're markedly less to get into a car accident, and having less of a taste for alcohol than their predecessors, are less susceptible to drinking's attendant ills. Psychologically, however, they are more vulnerable than millennials were. Rates of teen depression and suicide have skyrocketed since 2011, just in the past 5-6 years, anywhere and everywhere, so long as there's a cell tower, doesn't matter, cities, suburbs, small towns, poor, rich, every ethnic background, it's skyrocketed, the rates of teen depression and suicide. She says it's not an exaggeration to describe iGen as being on the brink of the worst mental health crisis in decades. See, they have their Instagram accounts, they have Snapchat, they have their smartphones, they have iPhones, and their minds are closing. She says here, the twin rise of the smartphone and social media has caused an earthquake of a magnitude we've not seen in a very long time, if ever. There is compelling evidence that the devices we've placed in young people's hands are having profound effects on their lives and making them seriously unhappy. She writes how that it used to be the allure was independence. Independence, young people growing up in the 50s or in the 70s and 80s that wanted to learn how to drive a car and wanted to get their license at 16 or 17 and wanted to leave out of the house and get a job and be responsible. You don't see that as much anymore. You don't see much dating, of course, back in the day. When there was dating, that doesn't mean it was always appropriate. But today, I mean, she talks about how a lot of older teenagers are content to not get a license or drive when they can have their parents take them around everywhere. That's sort of the way they've been brought up. They just don't want to take on any more responsibility. Mom and dad can take care of those things. Just give me the smartphone or the tablet. Just give me the devices that I need. And that's my social life, and that's my partying, and that's my addiction. She talks some about the work history or experience within this iGen, as she calls it, as compared to previous generations, and how that the percentages are going down. Those that are teenagers and who have a job or a part-time job. She says, of course, putting off the responsibilities of adulthood is not an iGen innovation. Generation Xers in the 1990s were the first to postpone the traditional markers of adulthood. But as they left their teenage years behind, Gen Xers married and started careers later than their boomer predecessors had. But now, you see, it's much worse. Now the childhood years, they stretch well into high school, she says. Why are today's teens waiting longer to take on both the responsibilities and the pleasures of adulthood? She says shifts in the economy and parenting certainly play a role in an information economy that rewards higher education more than early work history. Well, I guess I can skip some of this, but there's changes in what employers are looking for, so that might factor in somewhat, she says. But further on, she writes, 8th, 10th, and 12th graders in the 2010s actually spend less time on homework than Gen X teens did in their early 1990s. So she made the point previous to this that, well, they're at home more. They're not going out as much. And some have said, well, maybe that's because they're going to be more studious than previous generations. And they do spend more time in their room, but they're not spending more time studying. It says the time that seniors spend on activities such as student clubs and sports and exercise has changed little in recent years. Combined with the decline in working for pay, this means iGen teens have more leisure time than Generation X teens did, not less. I mean, they've got so much leisure time on their hands, and they're doing so little with it. What are they doing with all that time? This author says, this again is by Jean Twenge at The Atlantic. She says they're on their phone, they're in their room, they're alone, and they're often distressed. They're all alone with their phone, and they're not happy. They're not producing. They're not leading productive and fruitful lives. We'll come to some scriptures here in just a second, or at least in the next segment, because God has a lot to say about this. And if you know anything about the Bible, if you know anything about this world, if you know anything about the influence of the God of this world, none of this comes as a surprise. It's all like Paul said in 2 Timothy 3. Here we are adding all of these sophisticated advancements in technology, and it's just making matters worse. That's the great paradox of our day. All of this modern advancement and all of this unhappiness, all of this misery, all of these distressed teenagers. She says here, one of the ironies of iGen life is that despite spending far more time under the same roof as their parents, today's teens can hardly be said to be closer to their mothers and fathers than their predecessors were. And so you see them with their parents more than in generations past, but they're less responsible, and they're not really any closer to their parents. She, in interviewing one of these teens, the gal says, well, I see my friends with their families, but they don't talk to each other. They're all on their phones, including the parents. I've been on my phone more than I've been with actual people, says this one teen. A frank admission. And she's just a typical teenager. She's like many of the others, 75% that have their own iPhones. This author says the number of teens who get together with their friends nearly every day dropped by more than 40% from 2000 to 2015. So there's just so much less social interaction because the social action is online, social media. The decline here, actual interaction with people, the decline has been really sharp just in the past few years. It's pretty amazing, this development. Those phones, those applications, those social media sites, they're replacing actual people. And she talks about the way it was in her upbringing. She sounds like she's about the same age as me. The roller rink. I can remember going to that as a teenager. I can remember really looking forward to that. Skating. Or the basketball court. How many times I went either to the court indoor or to the court at the park. The pool. I wasn't much of a swimmer, but still. Still. I mean, you as a teen, you wanted to go out. I mean, you wanted to get out and see people. She says here, they've all been replaced by virtual spaces accessed through apps and the web. All of that physical activity. All of the wakeboarding and the touch rugby and the flag football. All of the social interaction, the dancing, the group dating. It's all been replaced by the apps on the internet and by those smartphones. You might expect that teens spend so much time in these new spaces because it makes them happy. But most data suggest that it does not. That's what she's concluded, and she cites several studies to make her point. She says later, the results could not be clearer. Teens who spend more time than average on screen activities are more likely to be unhappy. And those who spend more time than average on non-screen activities are more likely to be happy. There's not a single exception, she says. All screen activities are linked to less happiness. And all non-screen activities are linked to more happiness. In other words, get outside and you'll be happier. Get involved in non-screen activities, and it will increase your happiness. And she breaks down the numbers. And says later, the more time teens spend looking at screens, the more likely they are to report symptoms of depression. If you are going to give advice for a happy adolescence, based on this survey, she writes, it would be straightforward. Put down the phone. Turn off the laptop and do something, anything, that does not involve a screen. Do something. Now, again, the young people in God's church are different, but these influences are so strong that still the challenge is there for us to really encourage them to do something. We collect any devices that they bring with them to camp, and sometimes those can serve an important purpose, being able to get in touch with their parents and to use in the case of an emergency and so on. Of course, most of these devices these days are used as, you know, alarms. They're used for your camera to take pictures and such. It's incredible technology for sure to just have everything there in one device. But we collect them all at the start of camp and then proceed with doing something, anything, that does not involve a screen. In fact, there's a lot more structure than even just as I said it there. It's all laid out for us, the schedule, the lecturing, the social activities, the excursions, the field trips, the athletics, the cleanup, the service, the sermons, the Sabbaths, the etiquette dinner. She says here, social networking sites like Facebook promise to connect us to friends, but the portrait of iGen teenagers emerging from the data is one of a lonely, dislocated generation. Social networking, I mean, the promises and the promises that come from these sites. You can connect. You can be liked. You can have favorites. You can have friends. You can have followers. And it's all, in so many ways, just fake. It's an alternate universe. Someone used the joke, I think it was Joel Hilliker, used this joke at one of our mealtimes the other day. This is circulating around on the internet. This individual who says, presently I'm trying to make friends outside of Facebook while applying the same principles. Therefore, every day I go down on the street and tell the passersby what I have eaten, how I feel, what I've done the night before, and what I'll do tomorrow night. And then I give them pictures of my family, my dog, and me gardening and spending time in the pool. I also listen to their conversations, and I tell them that I love them. And it works. I already have three persons following me, two police officers and a psychiatrist. It's ridiculous to actually put it into real life. It shows how ridiculous it is. And yet online, I mean, this is what occupies hours and hours a week for so many of our young people, and adults too, for that matter. This article, The Atlantic, the author says here, and we're coming closer to the conclusion, but she says at the generational level, when teens spend more time on smartphones and less time on in-person social interactions, loneliness is more common, and so is depression. So is depression. You have 8th and 9th graders who are at serious risk of being depressed. On the other hand, those who are out playing sports or going to religious services or doing homework, that risk is reduced significantly. She talks about the suicide rates. There has been a decline in homicide rates among teens because teens don't go out as much. They don't have that conflict, that direct person-to-person conflict as much because they're not getting together much. But the increase in suicides, and even just in the last few years, I mean, this should set off alarm bells because it reaches through to every sector of society, in the cities, in the suburbs, the poor, the rich, rural communities, anywhere that there's a cell tower. It's pretty amazing. It should be very disturbing. It should be disturbing. It should be an alarm going off. And yet, well, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but the conclusion of this piece is about what you would expect in today's world, even when there's a pretty good, thorough account or explanation of what's happening to our young people. There's so very little in the way of solutions. And when you go back, and like I did with that 1984 program, I mean, you see how far ahead of his time Herbert Armstrong was. He saw this breakdown of the family for what it was back in the 1950s and 60s. He saw where it was leading, where it was headed. And he talked a lot. He talked often during his 50-some year ministry. He talked a lot about the paradox of today's world. All of this advancement, this progress, and yet the evils, the multiplying evils. This program, by the way, as I said, most of it's a narration together with footage and then a few short clips of Mr. Armstrong. This next clip I'll play for you is from the narrator on that 1984 World Tomorrow program, The Heart of the Children. This is clip two.
In this world that has made such awesome progress, millions of children and teenagers still are forced to live in inhuman conditions, without opportunity and without hope. And while the world spends $2 billion every week on war, every 2 seconds, a child dies of hunger. In the developed world, physical living conditions are better. Improved sanitation and medical facilities have greatly increased the children's chances of growing up. But the children of the richer world must face other serious problems, for Satan has flooded their world also with cruel deception and lies. In the midst of affluence, these children face moral and spiritual poverty. As Satan uses every evil device to undermine marriage, education, to pervert culture, and discredit what remains of the true values, children become ever more frustrated and confused. They become alcoholics or hopeless drug addicts. They're drawn to bizarre and perverted entertainment. And many are driven to suicide. In despair and frustration, children and parents have begun to lose contact and turn away from each other. The family, the basic building block of civilization, has begun to crumble.
That's from 1984, that clip. That's long before the internet came along. And mobile phones. And even, I mean, that was in the early stages of the computers as well. I forget when laptops came along. It was probably quite a few years before that happened. And as it says there, it even used the words devices, or Satan uses every evil device to undermine marriage and family. Here are these devices that young people are so attached to, they can't pull away from it. This article, by the way, she describes this one particular case from a couple of years ago where this teenager, for some reason, it caused people to get worried that maybe these phones were going to overheat and explode or melt, because this one teen went to bed with the phone and it ended up melting into the sheets by the next morning. And as this author brings out in the Atlantic piece, she went to her class the next day. I think she teaches at a college, and asks, well, this was kind of the reaction to this particular case where the phone melted. But I guess my question was, why would you even have the phone in your bed with you? And then all of these students in her college class talked about how that social media was sort of the last thing that they checked on their phone right before they went to bed. And it was the, and of course they use their phones for their alarms. So even if it's not right under their pillow, it's on the nightstand next to the bed. And then social media is the first thing that you check in the morning. And some of these teens admitted that, yeah, even if I wake up in the middle of the night, sometimes it's too hard to resist. I've got to get on the phone. And so this is introducing other serious problems, sleep deprivation being one of them. And then imagine the contribution that makes to this rise of despair and discouragement. Satan has just flooded this world with deception and lies, as you heard there in that clip. And here are these young people. They can't even break away from their phone for a few hours. They can't even put it in another room when they go off to bed. And so many of them are now sleep deprived, and they're not even going out and partying. They're not even going out. They're not working the late shift at work and then exhausted the next day because of that. It's because of their phone. It's because of Facebook. It's because of Snapchat. It's because of Instagram. She says here, finally, the correlations between depression and smartphone use are strong enough to suggest that more parents should be telling their kids to put down their phone. As the technology writer Nick Bilton has reported, it's a policy some Silicon Valley executives follow. Even Steve Jobs limited his kids' use of the devices that he brought into the world. He knew enough. He knew enough to keep his kids from using it too much. But where is that message coming through loud and clear? Whether from, you know, Apple or Facebook, not to put all the blame on them. I'll talk about parenting here in just a second. But I mean, these companies, they know the influence that they have. I mean, she brings out in her article how there's this Facebook document that was leaked a year or two ago, where Facebook was basically saying to advertisers, look, we can even determine their emotional state, these teenagers, just because of their online behavior. We can tell what mood they're in. I mean, and this makes for powerful, powerful information when we send this out to you advertisers. Well, it says here, at the conclusion of her piece, what's at stake isn't just how kids experience adolescence. The constant presence of smartphones is likely to affect them well into adulthood. And she talks about how important it is in those early years to develop social skills, to spend time with other people face to face, so that you can develop those social skills, so that you can interact with people. And then there's this. I realize, she says, that restricting technology might be an unrealistic demand to impose on a generation of kids so accustomed to being wired at all times. That's sort of the one very, very, very tactful admonition she gives. You know, maybe parents could try to reduce the use, keep their teens from just spending too much time on these devices. But she says, in the end, I realize that may be unrealistic. In other words, there's really not a lot that we can do. It's an earthquake-sized impact on family living. But there's not a lot that we can do. Well, there is a lot that we can do. There's a lot that you can do as a parent. And it's tempting to read through articles like this and to blame Facebook or to blame Snapchat or to blame iPhones. But the responsibility for how these developments, how these sites, how these technologies are used, that falls squarely on the shoulders of parents. I mean, who are the ones purchasing these phones? Who are the ones spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars, in some cases thousands of dollars, so that children have nonstop access to these kinds of devices? If your children are falling into some of these traps, then it's we, the parents, who are to blame. We're the ones that have to cultivate this environment of an active, healthy lifestyle. And that's what's promoted, relentlessly so, at PYC and at Armstrong College as well. It's not perfect, and there's things that we're tweaking. In fact, we tweaked a few things, because we did have quite a few lectures in the first few days of PYC. We tweaked a few things as we went to just make sure that there was a right balance between the classroom instruction and the strenuous activity, just like Mr. Armstrong said it should be in that clip I played for you, the first one. A balanced lifestyle. When we come back, we'll look at a few scriptures that give you God's perspective on this subject, on bringing up our children in the way that they should go, on strengthening and building the families rather than tearing them down and building a world where our children are becoming more frustrated and confused. It's a lot that we're going up against. But God equips us with everything that we need in order to build the family the way that God's family is. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, don't forget, I'd be happy to see some of your own experiences or hear about your experiences. If you can jot them down on an email, your experiences at youth camp, whether in the last couple of decades with the Philadelphia Church of God or even before that during the ministry of Herbert W. Armstrong. Send me those thoughts to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
In the closing verses of the Old Testament, God spoke through the prophet Malachi to our time. He spoke across the ages to a generation living near the end of 6,000 years of history. 6,000 years in which human beings have rejected God's ways and have reaped the bitter fruit of their own way. The society they have built is based on a foundation of greed and selfishness, It is ruled by Satan, once an angel of light, but now the adversary of God. It has become his world, and it is doomed to destruction. To this end-time generation, God would send a messenger whose commission, like Elijah of ancient Israel, is to restore the truth in the midst of moral and religious confusion. But this generation is not the last to live in the end-time world. Children have been born to them. Children whose destiny could be to live on into the world tomorrow to become the foundation of the new society that will fill all the earth. Against these children, Satan has waged a relentless and insidious war to destroy their potential and rob them of their destiny. The end-time world has become a dangerous place for children. The World Tomorrow. The Worldwide Church of God presents Herbert W. Armstrong, internationally recognized ambassador for world peace, visiting prominent leaders around the globe, discussing the cause of world problems, and proclaiming the good news of the world tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, Herbert W. Armstrong.
That's the opening there of that 1984 program, The Heart of the Children, based upon those closing verses of the Old Testament, Malachi 4, 5, and 6. You heard the distinctive voice of Art Gilmore, who was the announcer or the narrator for the World Tomorrow program for so many years. And of course, you had the inspiring theme music there at the end of that clip. I wanted to include that just because, what a contrast. I mean, we're living in a world where, I mean, it's a dangerous place for children. But there is hope. There is hope. God sent a messenger whose commission was to restore truth, even in the midst of this religious confusion, even in the midst of all of this evil. God said he would come. Malachi 4, 5, and 6. Behold, I send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. God has a message. God has a work aimed at children. He has all of these activities for the young people. And it was said there, I mean, this was from a program in 1984, and it was right in the opening segment. These children that had the potential to become the foundation of a new society, to live right on into the wonderful world tomorrow. We've established the theme for this particular youth camp, as I told you last week, as ambassadors for Christ. These young people are in this present evil world today to set an example, to represent God and Jesus Christ. And they have the potential to live on into the world tomorrow and to become the foundation of a much better world. And as I've been telling the campers this past week and a half, being an ambassador for Christ, I mean, that carrying that title carries with it a tremendous responsibility. A tremendous responsibility. Mr. Armstrong, as you well know, he named his college Ambassador College. He was really excited about that from the beginning. Back in 1947, when he first told the brethren, this is the name that we've come up with, and I think you'll like it. And it has a lot of meaning. There's a lot of meaning to it. and even more so in the church than what people would think in the world. There was a good news article from 1980 that said this about the college and its name. It says, when Ambassador College was founded, its name was not selected by accident. Those who are accepted have to really know why they want to go. And once they arrive, they are taught what it means to be an ambassador. When they arrive at Ambassador College, they are taught what it means to be an ambassador. High standards are set so that high standards can be reached. Those standards touch upon all facets of student life. Notice this: studies, finances, health, appearance, work, athletics, dating, and spiritual growth. I mean, that list that I just gave to you there, that's from the 1980 Good News, May of 1980. All of that, for the most part, is exactly what young people today don't do. They're not doing those things. Looking after their health and appearance, working hard, getting involved in athletics. I mean, again, there's a few exceptions, of course. Dating, spiritual growth, studies. It's like that author of The Atlantic piece pointed out. Even with her own children, she marvels at the fact that her little six-year-old can just grab a device, a handheld device, and know exactly what to do, sweeping her finger across the screen and moving to this or that. 6 years old. I mean, this is what our young people today are becoming experts at, working with devices and devouring content that at best is just trivial. And of course, the worst of it, you can't even really get into the kinds of things that our children are being exposed to. But Ambassador, and together with that, of course, Ambassador closed its doors back in the mid-1990s. Satan got a stranglehold on that church and destroyed everything that Mr. Armstrong had built. But Armstrong College and the Philadelphia Youth Camp, we follow right in that same tradition. We live up to those same standards. We try to set those standards high so that those standards can be reached. Those standards touch upon all facets of student life: studies, finances, health, appearance, work, athletics, dating, and spiritual growth. It goes on and says that, you know, if young people aren't striving to reach those standards, they don't belong at AC. They don't belong at Ambassador College. They don't deserve to be called an ambassador. Well, there's another one here that talks about, I gave this to the students last week, or the campers together with the students last week, about what kind of an example are you setting? Finding that balance, turning the hearts to the fathers, looking to the fathers, looking to that family government, and then leading a life of study and health and fitness, dating, interaction with other young people, growth, social growth, spiritual growth, mental growth. When you look at just the physical, I mean, there's a proverb that says the glory of young men is their strength. I mean, God looks at young people and says that if you as teenagers or young people are physically fit and healthy, this is a glorious quality. God sees that as a wonderful accomplishment, a real asset for His work. What kind of an example are you setting for this world? That's what I asked the campers last week. What kind of a Christian are you? Are you a good ambassador? There's another Good News magazine that I quoted from in my Bible lecture last week, aimed at these young people, that asked, are you a balanced, normal, friendly person? Is your countenance filled with joy, happiness, and radiance? Do people see your example and think, I wish I were as cheerful and happy as he is? I'd sure like to know that person. And it says, finally, analyze yourself. Face up to those questions. Begin working on yourself so that you will be a better, more effective, more influential ambassador for Jesus Christ, the greatest ambassador ever alive, who set us the perfect example. He certainly did, Jesus Christ. He set for us a perfect example of what it means to be educated and balanced and active and happy and positive and hopeful and a real servant. What an example he set in the way of God's love. Well, we can't fit everything into just 2 weeks of camp, but we're certainly doing our best with God's help to just try to expose these young people to as much of God's way of life as we can possibly cram into 2 weeks, or in the case of Edmund, the Edmund camp, 3 weeks. And if we do our job, as one of those clips pointed out, what a transformation. What a transformation we can see in these young people. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us some of your thoughts, even some thoughts that you have regarding your own youth camp experiences. You can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week.